You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. So if you're looking for any type of battery, from rangefinders to trail cameras to your truck, car batteries, anything, any type of battery that you can think of, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail location and talk with a battery specialist. For more information about the company and all of the batteries that these guys offer, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Welcome back, guys. Adam and Matt here at the QDMA Whitetail Weekend in Georgia.
The old Athens, Georgia.
That's right. We are here quarantined into our hotel room. Just kidding. We are at the only event happening in the world that hasn't been canceled.
The only conglomeration of individuals who care so much about deer and habitat. We're willing to fight through Corona.
Yeah, exactly.
No, this is, man, this has been a blast. This is the last day that we're recording this podcast on. So we've been here for 2 days. Kind of the first evening was a get-together, meet-and-greet, registration. And then the next day, we were at the QDMA, the headquarters, the building where all the, say, the magic happens for the organization. We had a lot of outside events throughout the day, different guest speakers, the opportunity to go to the University of Georgia, their deer lab facility. People walked through that, saw all of it. And then today was more of the seminar-type gatherings.
Yep. Yep. So yesterday we spoke on saddles and how we implement, you know, we had the tethered saddles. We had the new Phantom in last year's Manus. We were basically talking to a group of guys who traditionally hunt a lot of private ground. So how we use saddles in private ground hunting, and how it's not just for public land running gun hunters, but it can also be used for guys who have a pile of tree stands, but every once in a while you need to tweak and go to that specific spot. So presented yesterday in the field on saddle hunting, and then today, and the topic of today's podcast is increasing usable space for whitetails. Typically you hear usable space, and you hear it a lot with Kyle and Frank, a couple other consultants we have, that they use it a lot in the upland site, but it's a term that could really be used for any kind of specific game management. And since so many of our listeners are whitetail guys, or they may be quail guys, but they're also whitetail hunters, we're going to use it in a whitetail application. And so basically this was our little spill or seminar we gave today here at QDMA Whitetail Weekend, but we are going to jump into it and allow you guys to hear it right here on the podcast.
Yeah, definitely. There's so much to be able to take away from this topic. We talk so much about, let's just say, the spatial distribution of these different features. But what's important is the fact of just having them present on a landscape. And honestly, today's conversation, we kicked off this afternoon presenting, and obviously about usable space for whitetails. And then Craig Harper came right behind and discussed laying out a property. And so we were talking about prefacing the actual layout of a property, what needs to be there, why it needs to be there, and what's the value of those resources for the whitetail deer. So in combination here, it's kind of a 1-2 punch for all those in attendance to really understand the value that it takes, and I should say the value, the resources it takes in the management and layout of properties, to creating them for dynamic whitetail hunting. So we're going to break down basically one of our clients' properties, from South Central Missouri, and
yeah.
and take you from day one when we were on site and what that looked like, and then as we move through the recommendations and the slides that you guys unfortunately won't be able to see, you'll just be able to hear basically the presentation itself. But we're going to walk you through what the impact was, because
yeah.
it's so hard, Adam, to just talk about it and say, okay, this is good, this is good. This will be an addition. This will be a nice additive to this area of the farm. But like, what does that actually value? Like, without numbers applied to it, it's hard to quantify. What do you mean? How good? Like, what can I expect increase wise? But that's what we're going to do today.
Yes. Before we jump in, though, we got a quick shout out to one of our partners who make this podcast possible, Pure Air Natives. All kinds of blends and things that we've helped develop some blends with them. So to increase your habitat, whether it be for pollinators, quail, or deer, check them out at pureairnatives.com. First off, I guess when we get into this, we need to define usable space and really what that looks like. And,
yes.
you know, there's a great blog that Kyle wrote on our website that basically defines and talks about usable space, but basically we're looking, we're trying to quantify let you understand what usable space is. And in simple terms, we're just talking about usable space is suitable cover at a given time is how Kyle defines it. So you're looking over the course of a year, 12 months, and you're looking at an area that provides some sort of cover benefit and how long that can be. And so for whitetail, we kind of are looking at it from a space of going how much benefit is in cover that is also food and how long can we stretch that out over. So instead of having a cover factor that's good for 3 weeks out of the year, let's just say, let's use an eastern red cedar monoculture, provides pretty good cover, thermal cover, during a short period of time when that may be a severe blizzard or whatever. We're looking at how can we create a area that is cover, that is also food, that is beneficial for 6 to 8 to 10 months, or as long of a period as we can make that in a year.
Or if we need that great thermal cover, depending on the region, can we have that available on the property, but in relation, or let's say composition, it doesn't need to be 25 acres of 150 acre property.
Yeah.
We only need maybe 5 acres worth of that component because it's a smaller time frame in which deer are actually going to be using it, aka usable space. Why take up 25 acres when it really only needs to be 5, and then therefore we can increase the production out of the other 20 acres of the property. So, I think, I guess, initially, ask yourself, whatever property is that you hunt, you manage, you own, when are you seeing deer most active on the property? Like, are there gaps in activity where you're not seeing deer associating that much with the property? And that's what we're going to be addressing, those downfall, those lull periods.
Yes. So we've taken a typical property. It's 150 acres and kind of an odd shape. So a lot of guys, the dream property is a big square, but it's an odd shape. So a lot of guys can relate to it.
You don't always get that square.
No, you don't. And so you kind of have like a vertical panhandle that drops down into a couple 20 or yeah, I guess they're 40-acre squares, kind of an upside-down, backwards L shape. And, it's got a creek that runs through it, not a real big creek, kind of blows up with a lot of rain and then goes back down as a lot of gravel during the rest of the year. Access is, not great, but it's there at least.
It's workable.
And then you have 25 acres of hay field. This is when we showed up. So at 25 acres that's being cut for hay, not producing a lot of income, and is all tall fescue for the most part. There's few clumps of little blue stem and Indian grass popping up in these bottom fields, in these hay fields, but not a lot. It's dominated by tall fescue. And then the rest is timber. So that's kind of a breakdown. You've got, you know, the property key features. 110 acres of timber that is pretty much tall, closed canopy forest.
And kind of high stem density, low value from a quality and direction of that forest the way it's headed right now.
Yeah. And so, you know, when you look at that, very unproductive, but a mixed species. You've got a lot of hickories and oaks, and you have some understory trees with flowering dogwood. Then you have your classic eastern red cedar scattered through. Creek drainages, riparian areas, got some bur oaks, got some American elm and some hackberry. And then there's a unit in the eastern part of this farm that's got a unrestored glade that was, you know, choked out or is choked out. Eastern red cedars popping up through it quite a bit. Struggling native warm season grasses and forbs. And a little bit of post oak, chinkapin oak scattered around. Nothing there is really that productive because it's been unmanaged. It's been neglected. So what forbs and native warm season grasses are struggling underneath the eastern red cedar. The post oak is too thick. There's a lot of stems are competing with each other, so they're not really flourishing. And so kind of all things leading to a property that when purchased was very low productive landscape.
Yeah, and it's funny because what we see is that this happens all the time. Like, well, this is the condition of most recreational properties that we'll visit that a landowner maybe hasn't done that much. Maybe it's just new to them, and previous landowners never maintained for increased wildlife value or usable space. It just was a raw piece of land that, yes, there happened to be deer on it at certain times of the year utilizing it to some degree, but by and large, it's been unmaintained and underutilized. Therefore, the value to wildlife is really, really pretty low.
Absolutely. And so, and honestly, they can go back and listen to a podcast with this landowner talk about this property.
Yes. And it's called Client Success Transforming Rec Property. And that podcast was dropped back in December, early December of 2019. And so you'll be able to hear from the landowner's perspective what this property has endured since. So
yeah. So how productive at the time of purchase? You know, it's a lot of these values that we're getting ready to mention are pulling from the research that Dr. Craig Harper has done at the University of Tennessee Extension, that basically this is not just biomass produced. This is actually selecting what a deer eats. So instead of taking a plant and taking the whole plant and saying, okay, that's whatever that the weight, dried weight of that plant is, it's actually what a deer is selecting in the forage. So timbered acres, about 110 acres of closed canopy forest that's going to produce roughly 50 to 100 pounds per acre every year.
And we know that, you know, deer's consuming 2,000 pounds. So that's a lot of acres of just timber ground that it takes to be able to feed deer.
Now, one deer.
One deer. And we know that, no, deer aren't going to stay just in that timber. They're going to move around. However, that still provides us the lack of value that timbered acres produce. And this is not incorporating mass production, but we can't rely on mass production. We know that that is extremely variable from year to year, and so we can't just bank on it.
Especially in a closed canopy forest. Like
a closed canopy that's unhealthy.
Yeah.
Like we're going to have, even at that point, reduced mass quantities when there is production on those years.
Yeah.
So this is 80 acres of digestible forage, not including mass, but golly, that's bad.
Yeah, so you take 110 closed canopy, roughly, let's just say 80, somewhere in the middle. Yep. We're going with 80 pounds produced.
8,800 pounds.
8,800 pounds.
That's roughly eight deer.
Yeah.
On 110 acres, that would, let's say, quote-unquote support. But again, we know that even
more
in
more like
that,
four deer.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I totally did 1,000 pounds.
Yeah.
So four deer, but we know that okay, in that closed canopy system, we don't have forage produced throughout the entire year.
It's been a long day.
It has been a long day.
So you've got four deer that can really have enough that if living there year round.
Yeah, right, right.
They would have four deer food. That's not very good numbers at all. It's awful.
No.
And you think about it from a standpoint of a big picture, a landscape. Think about your neighborhood. If there's any timber and it's closed canopy and there's not a lot of undergrowth, woo.
Well, here's the funny part, and everyone's probably been guilty of this. You look at a landscape and you're like, okay, is there cover there? Is there cover there? And we're talking through an aerial image, 30,000 foot view, and all you see this big timber block, and you're like, oh, there's 3,000 acres of timber. There's piles of deer in there. We just learned that there's maybe 100 pounds of food in there per acre. But just because there's trees there and there's a big block of timber does not mean that it's one cover, nor does it mean that there is great food value. Therefore, it does not mean that there is a higher concentration of deer in that unit because it's a big block.
No wonder they leave to go to the neighbors. Yeah. Or they herd up in the winter and your deer vanish. No wonder that happens because there's not any food there. And we're just talking about food. What's the cover quality? Terrible.
Horrid.
The only reason you may see deer going there is because we stay out of it. It's like, the timber. That's where the deer are. Just
When was the last time you were there? Oh, I probably haven't been over there on that hillside for a year and a half. Well, okay. That kind of helps explain why we're just bumping deer out of it, despite it being horrible cover.
Yeah. And so then we go to the open acres, which is, the remainder, 40 acres of this property, give or take. That is mostly tall fescue, which is awful for deer and wildlife. So
quail, wild turkeys, white-tailed deer, there's very little, if any, cover value as well.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a double whammy from the wildlife perspective.
Very heavy monoculture, so we're not attracting a lot of insects for forage for quail and turkeys. The deer aren't eating it. It's not growing tall enough to be great cover. So therefore it's really, really bad. And then you go to the unrestored glade, which is, okay. It's a little bit better than everything else because we do have some natives present. So the cover is better. There are some forbs there. So the food value for deer is better, but it's still unmanaged.
I'm still calling it poor in its current condition.
Yeah. And this is just a typical property that you'd see in the Midwest.
But
where
this is typical.
You buy something, average. It maybe at one point was cattle, or it maybe at one point had hay cut off of it, but we're trying to restore it back to say, hey, these are my goals as a white-tailed deer hunter. Oh, we got work to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it just, there's a lot of things to do. When you consider, okay, so we know it's bad.
Yep.
Now, how do we move forward? How do we make it better? We're thinking about a white-tailed deer's needs from January to December,
because
12 months out of the year.
We have to go back to the usable space definitions. It's the value of a specific location over time.
Yes.
So we can't just evaluate of say, okay, I've got this on it, it's good. When is it good? When is it valuable? When are deer going to utilize it? When are they going to respond to it? So we have to break it out in months. So typically, what are we looking at for January to March? Of the cover type and forage type that deer are responding to the most.
Is ragweed growing? No. Pokeweed growing?
Not in this location at
all. So we're thinking woody browse.
Yep.
We need a lot of woody browse available from January to March.
Yep. So and young forest?
Young forest would be great. Shrubs would be great. Anything that's within reach.
Yep.
Woody browse isn't necessarily a woody stem. If it's above where a deer can reach, it's probably not that great. They're not getting any forage out of it.
Right.
So
and cover, therefore, is then lacking probably in that area or could
be
improved.
So a great thing would be young forest.
Yep.
You could look at blocks of young forest, or you could look at forest stand improvement or timber stand improvement to allow that there be some woody regen on some stumps in the forest from a big scale. But all we need is more browse available. That's what our goal is. So we can create hot spots of woody browse, or we can scatter it out across the landscape, and we'll explain what we mean by that a little later. Fast forward and go into more of spring green up. You go from April to June. We're starting to move into a lot of, like I said, spring green up. So there's a lot more plants greening up. They're very palatable. They're very young.
You can go into early successional plant communities, which would be phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
But guess how much early successional plant is growing in plant communities are growing in closed canopy forest? Very little.
Like a sprout, a sprig?
Even if the timber's burned, you're not getting a great response.
Here's the thing about burning with closed canopy. You're getting a glimpse. Like you're flicking a light on for 2 weeks, and then the leaves leaf out, and the light goes right back off.
Yeah.
And you're done. I'm done.
So if you're weighing out, where's time best spent? Is it better to burn closed canopy, or is it better just to cut closed canopy?
Cut away.
Because you can burn and burn and burn, but your response is very limited compared to take a year or two off from burning and spend some time just cutting some trees.
Yeah, absolutely. And trust me, there's a lot of trees in any given woodlot that don't need to be there, that aren't serving the purpose and are decreasing the usable space for whitetails on your property.
Yeah, because this is what happens when you burn closed canopy timber. You'll burn anywhere from January to March or early April, okay? And you'll get this immediate, you know, a week or two later, you'll start seeing green growth. And you think, oh, wonderful, this is great. But then March, April, May, wherever you're at in the world, you're going to see leaves start to grow, shaded once again, and the growth is cut off. And then you sit there with ankle to knee high growth. Knee high is a little bit of a stretch.
Don't get me wrong, it's better than not,
but I would much rather cut some trees.
But we can burn after we've increased the amount of light that's going to sustain more forage throughout the entire growing season.
Yes,
like that doesn't make sense. To you're pulling the cart before the horse by burning.
It's a practice that could be that is, yes, it's at the wrong time. You need to focus on
phases,
getting some sunlight before the floor. So April through June, early successional plant communities would be great to have.
Well, that's what they're wanting. That's what they're desiring.
As well as even some woody browse involved in that. So blackberry browse, black raspberry, just having the bramble aspect where they're still going to browse it while it's greening up, that'd be great.
But here's the thing that this is why we have to talk about this, is because if it's not on the landscape, deer aren't going to be able to utilize it. But if you haven't, I know it sounds stupid, but if you haven't experienced what old field or early successional plant communities are going to look like, then you're not going to know the value of them because you haven't seen or observed deer utilizing them. But I promise you, if it's there during these time frames, they will absolutely way prefer and spend majority of time in those areas because of the plant communities that are present and growing and offering usable space during these times.
So we're talking, we've covered two time periods here, January through June.
Yep.
You knock off a couple of months, January through April, we're talking about a deer is coming out of the rut for the most part. There's still some rut activity down south and other places, but for the most of the whitetail hunters, they're dealing with a November rut. And you go into that time frame. Rut's over. They're trying to recuperate, and does are pregnant, getting ready to drop fawns, and bucks are shedding antlers and getting ready to start growing more.
Yep.
What food plot species or crop species is going to be growing during this time frame? Not many. Alfalfa's greening up. Clover's greening up towards the tail end of this. But deer are starting to try to recover and get ready for the next growing season, the next year of raising fawns, the next year of growing antlers. And you can't be focused. You need to be focused on what you can provide during that time frame to get them ready for the next growing season. Mm-hmm. And that's through woody browse and then transitioning into early successional plant communities. And that's all going to happen long before soybeans or corn goes into the ground. So this is an important time frame to really manage, especially if you're in the northern part of the country and you're dealing with severe winters and high stress period. This time frame right here is when you need to be focused on young forest and early successional plant communities.
So what does July through September look like?
July through September is kind of that, it's an interesting time frame because you still have early successional plant communities, herbaceous plants that are providing forage. Some of these are starting to mature.
The early bloomers.
And so a lot of people say, well, the native vegetation's turning off late summer.
Well, some of them are, but then there's other ones that are doing phenomenal. And that's why diversity is key in this. But then you even get into some soft mass production. You can start seeing some American plums dropping fruit. You can see other plants dropping fruit. And we go into the early part of the fall with September. And so even some hard masses is coming in. So you've got a mix of soft and hard mass as well as herbaceous plants, early successional plants, which would be important. But how many soft mass are we seeing produced? Let's take Dr. Craig Harper's research with his thinning of basic crop tree release versus fertilizing oaks. He found that releasing those oaks, allowing them to produce more mass production, would be better if you thinned the forest and thinned and released these crop trees. Same thing could be true for soft mass trees. And so if you have a whole bunch of persimmons in the middle of a forest, you probably realize they don't produce a lot of fruit. But you notice the ones on the edge of fields produce more fruit.
It's funny how that sunlight stuff works.
Yeah. And so
And I don't say that like jokingly, but I guess I kind of do. But that seriously is as simple as it gets.
They need sunlight. Competition, really, they don't need that dense competition.
No.
And so they do better when you've got a little bit of nutrients. And so, you know, you can have more of that production, soft, hard mass, by just thinning some forest. But we'll get into it in a little while. Then you go from October to December, the last part of the year. What's an important part of forage in there? Hard mass. Yep. And once again, we're shifting back into woody browse.
Back into the woody browse very, very quickly. As that, depending on that mass production for that fall, you might have very little. You might have a ton. It just is variable based on the year. And so some years you could have a ton of young forest regeneration that's super critical in November when you don't have a red oak acorn crop and they're just transitioned directly into that. And then the next year you've got a bumper crop of red oaks and they're just foraging heavily on that all the way to January 1.
Yeah.
There's this variance back and forth. But again, that's why you have to have all these species. You cannot rely on one. If you rely on one, your usable space, like we're seeing on this property at this current time, is horrible.
Yeah.
It's very unproductive.
If you're like, I'm going to turn my whole place into young forest.
Dumb.
Well, then it'd be great during a certain time of the year. But they're probably the deer are going to leave during a certain time of the year to go find.
You're missing elements.
Yeah, early successional plant communities. Mm-hmm. And same thing. So when we talk about 12 months out of the year, we've talked about the forage values and what they're eating. But young forest, great cover. Early successional plant communities, you get that old field, great cover. During a certain time of the year.
Yep.
And so you do that. Now we have usable space. We have beneficial plant communities that are not only providing food but also cover.
Yep.
And so, therefore, anything else is just cherry on top,
yeah.
AKA food plots, crop fields, things like that. So,
but you know just as much as I do, food plots fail, crop fields don't get planted.
Yep.
Oh, this and that. Regardless, what do we got next here?
So, how are deer utilizing this property at the time of purchase? We talk about diversity all the time, and we kind of gave a heat map on where deer activity would be at the time of purchase. Well, in that first year, they did a little bit of cutting in part of the farm. So they had some young forest, and they had kind of this bedding thicket, temporary forest opening going on, which was odd, ironically enough, the hot spot of a lot of deer movement. And then you had more movement along the edge. And this is where people refer to deer as being creatures of the edge. And it's a question that we kind of ask. And I know Dr. Harper asks this a lot. Kind of drives him nuts. It's kind of funny to see him sometimes. But are deer really creatures of the edge? And it's of, he says, no, they have to use the edge because there's plant communities there that aren't found anywhere else that are important in their diet.
So that's a perfect example of the edge that a lot of people think of as high value, and what this property where the heat map basically is along the edges of these fields because the plant communities are that deer relate to are there. But outside of those, where the plant communities that deer would want to relate to, they're not there. They're not utilizing those portions of the property. And if so, it's extremely infrequent. And therefore, like, you can create those same plant communities that are now found along the edge everywhere. So yeah. It's sunlight. Not the fact that there's the edge present. It's the fact that the species that you're only seeing growing along the edge are there.
Yeah. So in this case, the fields, the open areas were cut for hay. Mm-hmm. So more perennial plants, shrubs weren't going to be growing there because they would get bush hogged down or cut down. But the sunlight factor is there along the edge. So we're looking just where the sunlight is coming in over the top of the hay field and in penetrating into the timber
20-30
yards. And that's where there's enough sunlight that you're getting this growth of different plant communities that once you go past that edge aren't happening because it's shade most days yeah. out of the growing season. So that's where creatures of the edge comes into play, that they're really only utilizing it because there's stuff there not present in the rest of the property. So very small when you look at a heat map of this place on where deer activity typically was. Well, it's not a lot of acres,
no.
And we need to change that. And so you look at
you have to look at the property basically as a business. And I think we've talked about this before,
yes,
on the podcast is, okay, if we have this common goal of making this 150 acres as beneficial or as useful to the deer, the species we're wanting to promote, then let's think of each acre on the property as an employee, because as a business and a business plan would do is address each individual person, employee. How are they going to be utilized? Like, what is their role in developing the business, furthering the business, adding value to the business to accomplish the goal of being profitable in whatever field that business is operating in?
Yeah.
But what happens in this scenario when we look at, okay, I've got 150 quote-unquote employees or acres that I'm dealing with, but I have 120 that probably just need to be what?
Yeah.
Fired. Something needs to happen
because they're underperforming. Pulled in and have a
serious conversation.
Coming to Jesus meeting
yeah.
Or completely let go from the company.
Yes.
Or you could even look at these as team leaders. They're leaders of an outfit over a whole acre of employees. Either way, we need change. And so basically, if you're looking at your farm from a business aspect and you're looking at each acre as a team of employees, and are they helping you reach your goals? Are they helping you reach your margin, your sales goals? If not, they get fired.
They got to be gone. And here's the thing that, man, I struggle with without trying to, like, push too hard. But truthfully, Adam, what we're – our job is to evaluate current state of the habitat, and if this was left alone down the road, what value does it bring? And in a lot of places, we find that if you left something alone, you're going further away, decreasing the value
from every
benefit.
Aspect.
Yeah,
your habitat, your wildlife holding capacity deteriorates. Your timber value deteriorates. Your overall diversity is degrading. Everything is degrading in the walk away method, the preservation mindset, because invasive species, mismanagement,
all sorts of things, lack of the continued disturbances. But the point is, you can't, like, you have to change, and you have to be willing to change acres. Like, give them a new name, give them a new purpose, redirect them with the various tools that we talk about every single week on the podcast to create that disturbance that will allow then those plant communities that we're wanting to promote that deer will relate to and need at some point throughout the entire year. If you just leave that alone, you're never going to get that acre, or maybe it's 10 acres or 20 acres. You're like, I don't really want to touch. It's kind of pretty. It's not helping you. It just, period. It's
yeah.
not, and it won't. It
no.
won't go to the goal. So that's fine if you want to devote that, if you're okay with that. But you have to know the reality of what it's doing or what it's not doing. And 10 acres can be a lot. Like, you did 10 acres, 150 acres. That's a considerable amount that you're like, eh, I'm
yeah,
not
doing. Yeah, think about it from the standpoint, too, of, like, if you've got 10 acres, it's only 10 acres. Well, there's a lot of guys that would kill to be able to manage 10 acres. Kill to do it.
I'll tell you what, you can do a lot of good in 10 acres.
Yeah.
A lot.
And so don't leave a stone unturned. Don't leave an acre unmanaged.
Yes.
And so, basically, when we're looking at this from a standpoint of forage and cover produced and overall usable space, look at it from a standpoint of going, okay, there's 110 acres of timber. There's 40 acres-ish of open pasture. What can we do to make this better? So from day one, now, fast forward, what we recommended. Number one, use herbicide to remove the cool season grasses from the hay fields, and promote early successional plant communities. So we're trying to fill that summer, spring, and summertime forage as well as year-round cover. And so spraying it out, removing it, and managing for diversity. And so we knew that the seed bank was probably there to be pretty productive because of the little blue stem and big blue stem that was seen while it was still fescue. So once that was sprayed out, within 1 year, we completely changed this landscape for years to come. Now, management over the next coming years is all we're doing is really removing invasives, Risa lespediza, autumn olive, whatever may pop up in that old field. We're going to remove those, can keep those at bay. We're going to manage it with fire, but also we're going to monitor the native warm season grasses so they don't get too thick. And if they get too thick, now we have cover, but we don't have forage. That's one big problem with native grass plantings or strictly native grass monocultures is they aren't providing any forage.
Correct.
If we want year-round usable space, we have to have forage in there as well with forbs. And so, and that's, you know, if it's straight grass, yeah, sure, it may be good cover for quail, but they need forbs. They need flowering plants to attract insects, so they have food. They need those forbs to produce seeds so they can eat that during the winter. If it's just strictly grass, you're losing the beneficial factors for year-round use.
Yep.
So then you go into the timber. How can we promote more young forest? Well, we can do temporary forest openings. So we can cut several 1 to 2 acre clear cuts in the timber to increase young forage regeneration. So we have that food from, you know, it's year round, but they're really going to key on it from October to March. And so we're trying to cut in enough areas to have enough food available so it doesn't get over browse, but not so big that it makes the hunting strategy a little bit harder because you have such big blocks of young forest that it's like they're probably out in the middle of it, but they may never come out for the next week.
Yeah.
So we're doing a bunch of bedding thickets, temporary forest openings or clear cuts scattered around to promote that young forest, which is great forage through woody browse as well as cover. Another big thing we're doing, we're restoring a glade. We're cutting cedars off the glade. We're thinning the post oaks, creating a healthier stand of post oaks so they produce more hard mass. And we're also returning fire to the scene in a diversity of fire so we can promote forbs if we need more forbs, or we can promote grass with more dormant season fires if we need more grass. And so now we're creating a glade, which is going to be great fall and winter bedding because it's in the sun. It's typically a south or a west facing slope, and also it's going to be filled with diverse forbs, so we've got year-round bloom, or not year-round but growing season, scattered different flowering plants, so we're attracting insects throughout the growing season, and then we have the seeds of the forbs throughout the fall and winter for birds and other species.
Yeah, so. I mean at that rate, here's all the different things that we're doing. We've addressed all the acres on the property with this little quick
one
plan
last
review.
Thing. Sorry,
go ahead.
Timber stand improvement or
yes.
Forest stand improvement, depending on if we're trying to grow timber, which they are in their oaks hardwood stands. So they're just removing. If you want to get technical, they're removing employee trees that aren't going to provide any benefit or aren't providing any benefit because they're 30 foot tall, and what forage they do produce is well without a reach of the deer. And they may be not produce, or they might not be producing hard or soft mass for other wildlife. So they're going through and thinning hickories if they're too thick, which they usually are in the Ozarks. They're thinning elms if they're too thick. They're thinning cherries if they're too thick. They're thinning oaks if they're not, if they're crooked or they're diseased or they just don't show any signs of being stressed for too long and they're deteriorating. They're cutting those out. They're getting sunlight to the forest floor scattered throughout the property. So at least we're getting some cover and some forage, but we still have our hot spots of young forest where we know deer are concentrating their bedding.
But we've addressed them. We've done something. We've either brought them into the office and had that serious meeting with those acres and said, here's the deal. You're going to continue to function as, let's say, a forest, but we're trimming a lot. We're letting a lot of sunlight in. Or
we're trimming
you're
the
gonna,
fat.
Yeah, you're going to be a field, but you're not going to be a field comprised of fescue. You're going to be a field comprised of diverse forbs and some grasses and some woody resprouts. Whatever it is, you're not gone, but you're transformed.
Yep.
And to usable space.
Yep. So how do you quantify the value added?
Yeah.
Let's think about that.
Because that's the whole point of this is like how much value by doing this does the property actually increase by?
Yes. So consider closed canopy forest. That was about 110 acres, producing 50 to 100 pounds per acre. So that was producing 8,800 pounds of forage. So you could hold four deer. Okay. That doesn't do us any good.
No.
If we're really wanting more, we got to get rid of that. We got to up our odds. So you could go to a managed forest, which, you know, depending on the site, depending on the slope, depending on the species, if there's more weed trees and we're cutting weed trees more than there's crop trees available, let's just go anywhere from 3 to 900 pounds produce. So we're increasing it. But in this on this farm specifically in the makeup, we're going to go average out at 600 pounds of forage produced per acre. So we're upping it a lot. Then you go into young forest. So we've got our different acres of temporary forest openings that's going to jump back into young forest. That's 1,000 to 1,500 pounds per acre. That's a big jump.
When you go from
50 to 100 to 1,000 to 1,500, that's a big jump. Yeah. And then, of course, we go from tall fescue pasture, which was a big goose egg for forage produced, to old field, which is 3 to 3,500 pounds per acre.
Talk about a jump. You can cover some ground and make up some ground on the usability, the forage, and because the cover in that is tough to beat. Great fawning cover, great cover if you have some shade components to it in the growing season, but then again during the fall as well. It's incredible. I mean it's really, really good value added to the property.
Yeah. So this is a graph that just honestly might be the top of the for this podcast, so you guys can see it, but time to tally up the increased forage, increased cover, overall increased usable space. So before we had just over 19,000 pounds of food on this 150-acre track. Okay?
So 19,000 pounds.
Which doesn't sound like...
It sounds like, wow.
Quite a
that
bit.
That sounds like 19,000. That's a big number. But
that's
in all reality, that's junk.
That's eight deer.
It's junk because the number we're about to share with you is what happens down the road. And I truly believe this, that just addressing this 150-acre property and the management that needs to be done to it, I think that this jump can happen within probably a 4 to 5 year range of your typical landowner with the time available that they have. If they were to address this plan, they could probably accomplish these numbers in 4 to 5 years. I think that's fair to say. And so we're going from 19,000 to
19,000.
Drum
so
roll.
That's eight deer, okay?
Yep.
Roughly eight deer that we could hold to 171, just under 172,000. So
pounds of food per acre on the exact same property. So if that food that we're trying to create by all these different management strategies also equals cover, then the usable space has drastically increased, but the food value increased by, I think it's 9 times. And therefore, how many deer can that hold then?
It could hold 86 deer.
Yeah, no, nine. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it's 150 acres, so we know that deer are leaving the property.
Yes.
But they're spending more time on the property because there's more forage, there's better cover, there's better usable space.
And we're not saying that 86 is the number of deer that we anticipate, want to, or try to hold. All we're saying is that is if you only, and we don't look at the spatial distribution of those said deer, that's the potential that the property could hold.
Yes.
Like, quote, unquote. Like, is that realistic? No. And that's not the goal. But what we're saying is that's the amount of food, and we always want additional food on the landscape, but that is the amount of food and forage that is going to be produced annually just by creating a, let's say, business plan addressing the acres that are unusable to deer and making them usable.
So, We made this more diverse. So there's more forage from January to December, whether that be through herbaceous plants, early successional plant communities, or young forest.
I have two things. Keep going.
And at the same time, we're now adding a habitat that can be used by bobwhite quail, more cottontail rabbits, more native songbirds, more insects, more squirrels.
Sure.
More wild turkeys, whatever it is, name the native species, we're creating a landscape that can produce more of the needs that those animals need.
It is obviously heavily, heavily skewed for production of whitetails, and that's the stated goal, but these other species will benefit. Here's the other thing. We didn't plant a dang thing. I mean, not one species was added.
Yeah.
We simply utilized the species that were there on the property. Yes, their current state need to be changed and manipulated, or we need to expose the seed bank, but nothing, not a fruit tree, not an oak tree, not a food plot in this equation was added into it. We didn't waste time doing that until we managed what was naturally occurring on the property. Nothing was planted. Everything was just simply changed its shape, changed its function.
The management changed.
That, yeah. I want that to sink in for people. That much big of an impact, and we haven't even planted a food plot.
No.
9 times just by addressing.
Money was spent on herbicide, maybe chainsaw. A chainsaw, sharpening chainsaw chains.
A sprayer unit.
Yep. Outside of that.
Fire.
Yeah. Just tools.
Just
that
tools.
You're going to use into the future.
Just tools. And sharpening your brain. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean,
the biggest thing was time and work.
Yep. 9 times the amount of production, usability, and function of a recreational property, 150 acres, changed for years and years and years and years to come.
So here's the thing. They actually did some of this work. They're still planning on doing more and more of the work. It's work in progress. But they've already seen quail.
Yep.
And he killed a really nice buck.
Yep.
Saw a lot of really nice deer, and they're seeing a huge increase in daylight activity with whitetail deer on their farm. But how
are
deer
utilizing?
You can
hear more about that there on the
podcast. Yeah, on that other podcast. How are deer utilizing this property before? We talked about a heat map. Now pretty much the whole farm, once this plan is implemented, the whole farm's going to be
red
because
– It's dark.
Because we've created quality – diverse habitat throughout the entire property. Now their deer they've got food, they've got cover, and they've got water already on the place.
And,
so,
and the important thing is, as we'll go to the next slide, is every single month of the year is addressed. There's not a time frame now that this has been recommended and beginning to be implemented that deer will be suffering or there will be a resource that is lacking or limiting on this property. Deer can spend their time on the boundary of this property for the entire year.
That's right.
There's not a window that's missing. And I'm sure that someone thought critically about their place and knew that, okay, I don't have any early successional habitat. Are they going elsewhere, or are they just not receiving that? Are they not benefiting? Because we want to recommend and design a property and manage a property so that deer are thriving and not just simply surviving. So what are the limiting factors there in your place? How are you going to increase the usable space on it? Is it going to be 5 times the benefit? Is it going to be 9 times the benefit? Is it going to be 12 to 15? Who knows? But you have resources available through the natural plant communities that can be utilized before anything is even added.
That's right.
Ugh.
Guys, I hope this helps you see the forest, the trees through the forest. Because if you look at your property as a business, there's a whole lot of bad employees on almost any farm you look at. There's bad employees everywhere. And so they either need to buck it up and get better, or they need to go.
Yeah.
You're fired.
Find another job. Get out of here.
That's right. You can either, we can change your role, and you can be a 30-foot American elm that's crooked, and we can change your role by cutting you now, and now you're stump sprouting, you provide a ton of forage and better cover. Yep. We can change your role in the property or in the business, or you just got to go. So it could be a type of tree species that we don't want, so we're going to cut you and
treat it.
We're going to treat the stump.
You've been fired.
You're gone. And now we're going to let some other employee take your place, whether that be a forb or another tree.
Yep. And we're going to just let it take its place naturally.
Yeah. So there you go, guys. That's kind of, we're increasing the overall productiveness of your farm. That's our presentation here at NWTF Whitetail Weekend.
NWTF?
Did I say that? QDMA. Yeah. QDMA.
As he's wearing a QDMA lanyard around his neck.
And it's been a busy spring. We've been at NWTF, and we also here at QDMA. So,
and big shout-out to QDMA. Man, they're doing some awesome stuff.
I can't believe we forgot it. But
what?
We should announce you're listening to the 2020 Al Brothers Deer Manager of the Year Professional Award.
We're definitely honored to have received that. Hopefully you guys saw the picture there on social media, but that is such a big thing. And thanks one to everyone who listens, because you're play a huge role in that. And to QDMA staff and to anyone who's utilized Land and Legacy and its services, huge thank you. And of course to our wives and family at home who, I'm not going to say they allow us to travel. They probably don't like
that
we travel.
They
tolerate it. Yeah, they tolerate it.
Yeah.
But, man, that was a huge surprise for us this weekend, but an awesome thing. Kind of a feather in the cap. So we know we're doing the right stuff. And the group of QDMA, like the staff, they're fun.
Yeah, they are. If you guys aren't a member of QDMA, you really should be. A great organization. There's nothing like supporting an organization who has a great mission or a great product, and the people are just as good.
Conservation-minded who are trying their best to make the resource as healthy and as enjoyable for anybody and everybody across the country, that is QDMA at their heart, and they spend a lot of time and resources in doing that. Learning a lot about the Field to Fork program this weekend too, which is awesome. Hopefully we'll have some more information coming down the road on that program, how people can get to be a part of that. But please spend some time, become a member of QDMA. You will not regret that information, and your dollars and cents going towards conserving the whitetail deer.
That's right, guys. Thanks once again, and we'll catch you next week.
See ya. Yep.